Okay, so James chapter 3, where we're studying, and we got well into verse 14 last Wednesday night in our study together, so we want to continue there, but to refresh on our context, this chapter that's been about the tongue, especially, down through verse 12, and then building on that in verse 13, he asked that question, who is a wise man and endued with knowledge among you? Well, we need to have that wisdom to be able to bridle our tongues and our whole bodies, and if we are, if we're lacking wisdom, chapter 1, verse 5 told us what to do about that, and that's part of what we need in order to be spiritually complete and entire and lacking nothing. We can't be lacking in wisdom and be lacking nothing. And this is the same goal here in James 3, as he put it in verse 2, when we're no longer causing anyone to stumble in with our words, then at that point we are a perfect man, complete man, and able to bridle the whole body also. So this is requiring that same wisdom for that to happen. So he's asking, do we have that? Well, we need to be honest and look at ourselves in the mirror and answer the question. And if we do, then what are we going to be showing? He says, let him show out of a good behavior, that word conversation means his works with meekness of wisdom. Then in verse 14, so that wisdom is necessary and will be demonstrated in our works, then he puts the contrast there. If we have bitter envying and strife in our hearts, then he says, glory not and lie not against the truth. So that would be the opposite of having that wisdom and being endued with knowledge. If we have bitter envying and strife in our hearts, well, then we're obviously lacking in that wisdom, and we're not going to be bridling our tongues, and we're not bridling our whole body. So we need that wisdom then. The other part of that, as we noted, when he's asking that question, who is a wise man and endued with knowledge among you? Well, even though we all want to jump up and say, yeah, that's me, we need to be look at ourselves in the mirror and see what we are, like he taught us to in chapter 1, and not deceive ourselves. Because if we're saying, yes, I have that wisdom, I'm endued with knowledge, but then he's letting us know if we have these other things that are being produced, that are in our hearts, which will produce the fruits from our words, from our tongues, and from our whole body also in different ways. But if that evil's in our heart, and he's identifying the source there very clearly in verse 14, when he was talking about mentioning the fountain in verse 11, and then verse 12 also, and the tree and the vine, he's asking, does that produce two different kinds of salt water and sweet? Does it produce fig tree, bear olive berries, or the vine figs? No, the answer is each produces after its kind. It's not supposed to produce something different. Well, we shouldn't be producing a mixture. Well, for us not to do that, the heart is the issue. And so we don't need to have any bitter envying or strife there. We went through those words in detail last time, last Wednesday night. But he says if we have that, then glory not. By the way, that particular word, glory, when he says glory not in verse 14, that's a long compound Greek word, katakakomai, that's my best attempt at it, is a really, really long word, We actually saw it in chapter 2, verse 13. It's only found three places in the Bible, and I think we mentioned it then. But in chapter 2, verse 13, is where he said that mercy rejoices against judgment. Rejoices against, those two words in English. That's the same, that same Greek word there, which means to exult against. So we're not to exult against. So when he says that we're not to, to boast. The other place that is found is in Romans 11, verse 18, when he was talking about the Gentiles in those branches, not to be boasting against, using that same word there. So that's it's not a word that's used very often in the Scriptures, but the three times it is, it's very clear in what it means. But there's a positive way when it comes to mercy rejoicing against judgment in chapter 2:13, but this is in the negative sense, like Romans 11:18 is. And well, we should not be exalting ourselves against the truth if we have bitter envy and strife in our hearts. If we're claiming to be this wise man and endued with knowledge, but we have bitter envy and strife in our hearts, which is going to be coming out of our tongues and our other deeds, then we don't need to be exalting ourselves against anything. I mean, and he says, and lie not against the truth, because that's what we're doing then. Just like he said in chapter 1, if we look in the mirror and then we go away and forget what we just saw in it, and we're not seeing who we are and we're not doing something about it, then he says we're like that one who looks in the mirror and then goes his way and forgets what manner of man he was. And then what are we doing at that point? What kind of religion are we practicing in the next verse? James 1:26. I mean, that's when we are... when we don't have our tongues bridled, and then we're, he says our religion is in vain. So though we seem to be religious, if we're looking at ourselves in the mirror and then we're not doing something about the problems and they remain there, then we're going to be practicing vain religion. So we'll be, it'll be a false boast when we say, yeah, I have that wisdom, I'm endued with knowledge, and we're going to be lying against the truth. We're not going to be telling the truth about ourselves. We'll be deceiving our own hearts, as he put it there in James 1:26. And that might make us feel good for a while. I mean, if we convince ourselves, we rationalize and convince ourselves that we're great, I mean, we may feel very good about ourselves for a while, but it's a lie. And we've deceived ourselves. We've been lying to ourselves then. And how long does that good feeling of being convincing ourselves that we're wonderful, how long does that last? I mean, we're not fooling God. If we just cruise through the rest of our lives doing that, which is actually what most people do, right? I mean, every way of a man is right in his own eyes, Proverbs 21:2. I mean, how many people don't think that they're good people? I mean, if we were asked that question, are you a wise man and endued with knowledge? Are you a wise and knowledgeable person? How many people can say, nope, I'm a fool? I mean, it just nobody's going to say, I mean, if you just go by what people say, then this world is absent any fools. But is it? Well, we know better. But how many people are going to say, yeah, I'm not very good. I'm not a very good person, and I recognize that, but that's just the way it is. I mean, people have a hard time living with themselves like that. So the devil sells us a big lie about ourselves, and most people are very eager to swallow that, and we have to fight very hard against that to not do the same. But if we are lying, deceiving ourselves, then what happens when our life comes to an end? Think for a moment. We all remember Luke 16, the man that was rich, where Lazarus was at his gate with his sores and with his hunger, hoping to get some, for the dogs to lick his sores, to get some crumb from that man's table. He fared sumptuously every day, was clothed in the finest. When he lived that life that he had, really, realistically, through that life that he had, what do you think he thought of himself? Do you think he was really thinking, okay, well, this is all going to come to an end very soon, and I'm going to be in flames and torment, and I'm going to be begging that guy that's outside my gate there to be able to come over and give me some relief. But right now, with what I'm eating and how I'm dressed and this house I'm living in, that's worth it. I mean, do you really think that was him? Or was he more than likely feeling pretty good about himself, thought he was an okay guy, and he was going to go to heaven one day and was very much enjoying his life, probably thought that was a reward for his righteousness. But what do you think he was expecting what happened when he died? And as it says, he died and then there he was in torment. It's very unlikely that he was anything but very surprised that when he died, that's where he went. And, I mean, how many people, when they die, end up in that same place he is? I mean, that's the vast majority of people. How many of them arrive there and say, yep, this is what I was expecting? I mean, very few would. So, I mean, it just shows the price of being deceived. And that rich man, who was no longer rich, was very aware of that. He knew he had five brothers that were just like him, and he knew they weren't expecting to be there. But he knew what they were doing, just what he had been doing. And they were going to end up where he was, and that's where he was trying to get Abraham to intervene by sending Lazarus back from the dead for their sakes. But that's the sad thing, is that most people, almost everybody's just cruising through this life feeling great about themselves and thinking they're fine. But they're not. And then the price of that, though, is losing your soul. If we don't recognize what our problems are, what's in our hearts, and do something about it this only time that we can in this life. So that's Proverbs 14:12. There is a way that seemeth right to man, but the end thereof are the ways of what? Death. So it seems right, feels right, but it's not right. And continuing on that road is going to lead to destruction, eternal destruction. So he warns us not to do that. Again, just like he did in chapter 1, let's not deceive ourselves. We need to see who we are, what's in our hearts. Well, are we full of that wisdom and knowledge of God? If so, that's going to be produced from its fruits and from our tongues. And if we have all of that wisdom that we need and we're not lacking any, then we are going to be that complete man and able to bridle our whole body along with our tongues. But what's going to tell the truth? I mean, how can we tell what's there within us? When we're looking in the mirror, how do we do that? I mean, God's word is that mirror. But how do we see ourselves in that mirror? Well, we have to examine ourselves. But here we are in this chapter where he's teaching us, this is what your tongue needs to be like. What's the question we need to be asking? What is my tongue like? I mean, what kind of words do I speak? I mean, we have to be honest there and not lie to ourselves about it and start making excuses. Yeah, I said something bad, but it was that person's fault. We have to look and see what's coming out of our mouths, because that tells us what's in our hearts. If we think about we see what God teaches about what we should say, how we should behave, and there's more of that to come here that we want to be looking at here shortly, to the end of this chapter. How does he teach us in Matthew chapter 7 to be able to discern a prophet? This is part of the Sermon on the Mount, but let's go to Matthew chapter 7 refresh ourselves on this. But he tells us how we can know. verses 15 through 20, Matthew 7, 15 to 20. Beware of false prophets, which come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravening wolves. So there's the problem is the appearance. When you just look at them on the outside, what do they look like? What kind of clothes they have on? How can you tell a wolf in sheep's clothing from a sheep? Well, if you're just looking on the outside, I mean, they both have wool and they look the same. That's obviously not going to be enough for us to tell the difference. So what does he say? Well, he's telling us what's on the inside. They're ravening wolves. Verse 16, you shall know them by their fruits. Do men gather grapes of thorns or figs of thistles? These are some of the same comparisons, same types of analogies that he used in James 3 that we saw. But he says, even so, every good tree bringeth forth good fruit, but a corrupt tree bringeth forth evil fruit. A good tree cannot bring forth evil fruit, neither can a corrupt tree bring forth good fruit. Every tree that bringeth not forth good fruit is hewn down and cast into the fire. Wherefore, by their fruits you shall know them. Well, how do we know ourselves? We got to look at our own fruits. What are those fruits? Our words, our actions, these things that he's speaking about there in Matthew 7 that he also does in Matthew 12 about our words and out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. The same thing that he does in Matthew 15 when he teaches us that it's what comes out of a man from the heart of man that defiles him before God, that he also teaches in Mark 7, and we see also in Luke 6, 43 through 45. Almost the same words that we just read there in Matthew 7. We have these references, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and plenty of other passages, and in James 3, where he's describing our heart as the source and the producer of these fruits, our thoughts, our words, and our deeds. That's what we need to look at. When we see evil or corrupt fruit produced by somebody else, well, that tells us what's in their heart. And if it's evil, then they're not a sheep. Well, then we got to look at ourselves too. I mean, we have to be very good fruit inspectors as far as who's teaching us. But what good is that going to be if we're not a good fruit inspector towards ourselves? And then we've just deceived ourselves anyway, and we end up where that rich man went. So it's we've got to be able to discern what is being taught by others to us and one another. And we have a big responsibility to defend ourselves, all of us, from falsehood, false doctrine. But if all we do is listen to the truth and we don't listen to any false doctrine, but then we deceive ourselves about who we are, then what's it gonna win us in the end? So we have to be very good at looking at our own fruits also. So we need to look at our words, our actions. And that's what's going to tell us whether we truly do have wisdom and knowledge in us, like he's speaking about there in verse 13 of James 3, where we're not lacking in that. We will show that out of our good behavior, our works with meekness of wisdom. They're the fruits. We need to look at the fruits. What are we producing? If we have bitter envying and strife in our hearts, well, how are we going to know that that's what's in our hearts? It will produce the fruits thereof, which he's going to speak about again in verse 16. For where envying and strife is, there is confusion in every evil work. That's the fruits. So if we're producing that with our words and our actions, then are we endued with knowledge and wisdom and knowledge like he asks in verse 13? No, the only way we can answer that question accurately that he's asking us in verse 13 is to look at our own fruits produced from our own hearts. Now, the truth is, as long as we are still growing spiritually, we are likely to see what he was talking about in those verses right before verse 13 about the fountain and the tree and vine. I mean, we're likely to be seeing a mixture of different fruits being produced. Or if we use the other analogies that he does right there, sweet water and bitter, or salt water and fresh. I mean, we are likely to be producing a blend of good and evil, because while we're still growing spiritually, what's there? Until we're complete and we have all of the evil purged out, and only in all of what is of the love of Christ formed in our hearts, then we're going to have some good and some bad there, right? And that's going to produce a mixture. Now, the more we've grown, it should be a lot more of the good and a lot less of the what doesn't work God's righteousness. So it's not like it should be an even 50-50 split. But as long as we're still growing, there's likely to be some of that fruit produced that's going to let us know if we're looking at ourselves, examining ourselves, and we're constantly monitoring the fruit that we're producing by our words, our thoughts, and actions. We're going to recognize when it pops up, okay, that says I've still got something in my heart that needs work. Among the big ones that need to go and go quickly as possible is that bitter envying and strife that's in our hearts. But if that's there, or any other, it was in chapter one of this same book that we saw the real standard. Is it just what's going to produce confusion in every evil work? I mean, that's the worst of the fruits. But what did he tell us about what to do with anger in chapter 1 verses 19 and 20? Where he said, "Wherefore, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath, for the wrath of man worketh not the righteousness of God." So what's wrong with the fruit of anger? He says the envying and strife produces confusion in every evil work. Does he say anger produces confusion in every evil work? Now, it opens the door, and that's why he said in Ephesians 4, when he warned us about anger and not let the sun go down on it, but he says neither give place to the devil. We're giving the devil an opportunity if we get angry. We talked about that at length when we were in chapter 1. But the standard that he gives us in James 1:20 for why we need to get rid of anger, even if we do the best job and grow enough to where when we get angry, we don't fly off the handle and say something that we shouldn't or do something that we shouldn't, that we just boil and stew in silence and without causing any problem, that's very, very difficult to do. But even if we got to that point and did that, there's still a problem, isn't there? What is it? What does it say about the anger of man? Yeah, so what's wrong with that fruit? Well, what is good fruit? So good fruit is, the definition of what is a good fruit is not, well, it's not a sinful fruit. It is not an evil fruit, therefore, by definition, it's a good fruit. Now, that's not correct. To be a good fruit, it actually has to be good. And how is he describing good in James 1:20? If it's good, it's going to work the righteousness of God. I mean, there's a great definition of what a good fruit is. Does anger do that? So does he say, well, keep producing that fruit because it's not evil? No. I mean, we can see that there can be, we can produce good fruits, we can produce evil fruits, we can produce fruits that are just fruits that don't work the righteousness of God. There's lots of vain things that can occupy our hearts and that can produce fruits that are not necessarily evil, but they're not working the righteousness of God, therefore it's not good fruit. What kind of heart does the Lord want us to have? Good hearts that produces good fruit. By definition, it's going to be working the righteousness of God. And that's what we need to be inspecting with ourselves. That's what we're doing when we look in the mirror. That's what we're supposed to be doing. And So looking at our words, looking at our actions, examining our thoughts. And unless we express our thoughts, that's one thing that, I mean, as soon as we speak, unless we're just talking to ourselves and nobody else is around, but when we speak generally, it's directed towards somebody else. Somebody's going to hear it. And if there's a problem there, well, we should be able to see it, but somebody else will also. But unless we express our thoughts and words, would it be fair to say that words are usually associated with some thought that comes ahead of it? Well, maybe we're speaking without any thinking. I think my mother once told me, or a few times told me, maybe I was doing that. But anyway, or seemed to. But we do need to think before we speak, but we generally do. But it may not be something good. But if we think it and we don't say it or don't actually take some action, who's going to know about our thoughts? Can we be thinking stuff that nobody ever knows about? Nobody else but ourselves and God? Yeah, that's there's a lot of that going on. But what do we need to be doing with that? I mean, that's really where the battle starts. And so when in something... Now, can... Jesus was presented with the thought, cast yourself off the pinnacle of the temple. Now, was that from him? Or did the devil present a temptation? Why don't you do that? I mean, that wasn't Jesus there. That was the devil presenting that. What do we do? I mean, can we stop that from happening? To where the devil doesn't present anything to us to think or say or do something that's contrary to the will of God. What control do we have of that? Well, of course, I mean, maybe we can put ourselves into positions where it brings more on there, and we should not do that. We can definitely put ourselves into situations where we can enhance or increase temptation that will come upon us, and we're told to flee from that and such things. But if we're being as careful as we can to avoid all of that, I mean, are we going to be able to lead a temptation-free life? Or what have we been studying in the book of James? I mean, how did the book begin? How do we grow? We've got to have trials on our faith, and that's why we count it all joy when we fall into divers temptations. And we know God doesn't tempt us with evil, it's the devil. That's in James 1:13. But he also tells us that if we overcome that, then we will be given the crown of life in James 1:12. I mean, so how important is it that we actually have temptations presented to us so that we can battle against that, overcome it? How else are we going to grow? And how else are we going to ultimately have the crown of righteousness? That's why we're here. I mean, we're here in the flesh now. And a big part of that is so that we can be subject to those temptations. Why was Jesus made like us in all ways when he came here and made in according to the flesh like we are in all things? So he could suffer temptation. And he was tempted like we are in all points, yet without sin. But was it important for him to have that, to go through that, and endure those same trials in his faith and grow spiritually too, so that the captain of our salvation was made perfect through sufferings, so that we can follow his example? I mean, that is of utmost importance to us. But the temptation is going to come. I mean, who's in charge of that ultimately? The lot is cast into the lap. By whom? Long before we don't know the time frame exactly, but before Job ever faced the temptations that he did that we read about in the book of Job, there was God when Satan presented himself saying, "Have you considered my servant Job?" And then it was the limitations were set and what the devil was permitted to do. And then Job had those temptations brought upon him by Satan as God gave him permission when God was the one that brought him up. Does God ever speak our names? And have you considered my servant? Just ponder that. Do our names come up there, up in heaven? Do we end up facing things? We don't know. We're not privy to those discussions of what's going on there. But did that only happen to Job? Very unlikely. I mean, Job is given as an example, isn't he? I mean, aren't we told expressly while we're studying the book of James? Well, I mean, what are we going to be reading about in the next chapter, in chapter 5? I mean, who are we to take as examples? The prophets, and who does he mention specifically? Job. So what happened to Job, if there's nothing to relate from him to us, and that was just a special case or category, and it's not going to be, we're not going to be in that at all, then how can we take him as an example? It's very likely that there are such conversations, things going on. We don't hear about those things. We don't know about those things. We see the result, though. Temptation. But when it comes, and when the devil presents us to look at that, think about that, say that, do that, what happens next? I mean, that's what James 1 was teaching us. What is our job then? Well, to do what Christ did, and when it happened with him in Matthew 4 and Luke 4, and while he was on the cross and throughout his life. But we have to endure it, and the problem is, as he said in James 1:14, every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust and enticed. Then when lust hath conceived, it bringeth forth sin, and sin, when it is finished, bringeth forth death. So what do we need to be making sure doesn't happen? Well, that we're drawn away of our own desires, and then that desire conceives because it's going to bring forth sin. If we're trying to resist anything that doesn't work God's righteousness, then we've got to take that captive and win the battle against that temptation before it ever goes any further than what the devil presents to us as in, do that or say that. And that's what Jesus did, and how did he do it? What did he do immediately every time the devil presented him with a thought? It is written. He had the scriptures ready. He knew what God said. So he had examined fully all that God had said and knew and had the shield of faith ready. And then he quenched the dark with that faith, that shield of faith every time. And that's what we have to do. And that's part of that armor of God that we have to put on, of course, as we know from Ephesians 6, but also in 2 Corinthians chapter 2 Corinthians chapter 10 in verses 4 and 5, he says, "For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds, casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalteth itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought." And that word thought, that's actually a form of the word nous, which is the mind, to the obedience of Christ. But the description is there of what the process there with that, these spiritual weapons, the weapons of our warfare, which are mighty, we need to be bringing into captivity our minds. So when the temptation is there, we've got to take that captive unto the obedience of Christ, rein it in with the shield of faith, resist the temptation, and then make every thought that is in our minds to be to be obedient to Christ. So we have to be fighting the battle right there. And if that's where we fight the battle, then we're going to be growing more and more in the image of Christ, in that wisdom, and we're going to be able to then produce more and more good fruit. So that all ties into these things from chapter 1 and chapter 2 with that faith that works. It ties in with what he's teaching us here in James 3 also. And here we're looking at our hearts and seeing what fruit is being produced. But we need to make sure that we're not producing this evil fruit, corrupt fruit, or any of this fruit that would not work the righteousness of God. All right, in verse 15, he says, starts this wisdom. And it's actually literally, it's this. Sophia is not there in that first part. But that, when he says this what? Well, what did he ask the question about in verse 13? Who is a wise man among you? And then he told us to show out of our good behavior our works with meekness of wisdom. And then we're also going to have verse 17 where he says, but the wisdom that is from above. So what's the contrast to that and in the context? Well, he is talking about wisdom there. So this wisdom, does that seem like a wisdom? Bitter envy and strife in our hearts where we're convincing ourselves, or lying to ourselves and saying that we're wise and endued with knowledge when we're not? That doesn't seem very wise. Well, it's not of a kind of wisdom, not the kind of verse 17, but it is the kind that he's talking about here in verse 15. So how many kinds of wisdom are there? There are two kinds. We're reading about one kind in verse 15. We're going to be reading about another kind in verse 17. They're opposite. So there's more than one kind of wisdom. This should not be shocking to us. There's more than one gospel. There's more than one Jesus. There's more than one Spirit. Now, there's only one true and right. But as far as what exists, I mean, there's what is true and there's what is false. That's true also that's the case with doctrine. There is what is true, what is God's word, and what is false. So the world has its gospel, its doctrine, its Jesus, actually many of them, and many spirits, and many lots of things, its wisdom. But what is the point about that? Well, we have what is here in this world of all of those things, but there's only one of what is from above, as he says, of God's wisdom in verse 17. So the possibilities for wisdom are that it's either from above or not from above. So verse 15 says, this wisdom descendeth not from above. Now verse 17 says, but the wisdom that is from above. So those are the two opposites, and they're identified or distinguished from their source. One is from above, the other's not from above. And if it's not from above, where is it from? Well, what's he going to tell us in verse 15? This wisdom descended not from above, but is earthly, sensual, devilish. So we need to recognize these two possibilities for wisdom, but they're also the same two possibilities for us and for all of these other things, because we're either filled with the wisdom of men or the wisdom of God. We're either following after the wisdom of men or the wisdom of God. We're either listening to the truth or error. We're either following the true Christ, the Son of God, or following a false one. So in all of these things, we have to be able to distinguish, well, which is, what is truth, what is error, and what am I following here, or what do I have in me? So he says that this wisdom, that word descends, it just actually means it is. It's translated descends because, well, I'm not sure why that particular, because if it's not from above, is it really descending? If it's earthly, sensual, devilish, well, it clears up the confusion to know that the actual literal word is the Greek word esti, which is the word, it means is or are, whether it's singular or plural. So it's literally, this is not from above. I mean, if you wanted an actual word-by-word literal translation of the beginning of James 3:15, it's this is not from above. Well, it is. He's speaking about this wisdom in contrast to God's, but it's not from above. That's just a plain statement about its source, where it isn't. If it's not from above, then it's not God's. That word, when he says from above, which is the same exact word, now it's two words in English, from above. It's anothein, which is 509 is the number in Greek. It's the same word that's in verse 17, the wisdom that is from above. That word or a very close form of it is used a few times elsewhere in the New Testament, but it's instructive to look at a couple of places where we can learn a little bit about that with, as he's showing us the difference between what is from above and what is not. Because that's really the question we need to ask about everything, is what we're following, what we're believing, what we're doing, is it from above or is it not? In John chapter 3, let's turn over there for a moment, John chapter 3, in verse 31. Now the one we're following is from above. And so here, look at the contrast here. John 3:31, he says, "He that cometh from above is above all. He that is of the earth is earthly, and speaketh of the earth. He that cometh from heaven is above all." Now we notice the contrast, and this is very true. Christ, who he's speaking about there, is from above. I mean, he was sent from his Father. He is God's Son. And the words that he spoke were from where? From his Father, from above. Now, though, what's the alternative or the contrast to that? If we're following him, we're following the one that's from above. If we're not, then we're following something from where? What does he say? What's the contrast from he that cometh from above? He that is of the earth. And he that is of the earth is what? Earthly. What does he speak of? This is similar to what we see in 1 John 4:6 with our words. This is a great opportunity to look at it that way, to examine the fruits of our own tongues. Because he says it right there. If someone is from this world, well, they're going to be spotted with the, remember James 1:27, to that pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father. What is the last part of that? To keep ourselves unspotted from the world. Well, if we're of the world, I mean, we're going to be covered in its spots. Is that just something we see as an outer garment? Of course, he's talking about what's going to be in our hearts, and that's going to be produced by what's going to produce our words. And if we're of the world, what are we going to be talking about? If we're of the earth, we're going to be earthy, and what we speak is going to be of the earth. 1 John chapter 4, in verse 6 says, "We are of God. He that knoweth God heareth us. He that is not of God heareth not us. Hereby know we the spirit of truth and the spirit of error." Well, of course, verse 5, "They are of the world, therefore they speak of the speak they of the world, and the world heareth them." The way we talk had better be very different than the way the world does. If there's no difference in as far as subject matter, particular words that we use, the language and all that, I mean, if it's identical to anybody else in the world, then what does that mean? So there we have an opportunity to look at ourselves in the mirror when he's saying, if we need to follow Christ who's from above, and that's and his wisdom is from above, and he didn't speak of this earth. Those of the earth are earthy and they speak of it. Those that are of the world speak of the world. And what do they think of our speech? What we talk about. They got no use. Not only do they have no use for it, they hate it. And they're going to persecute us for that. We need to expect that. That's what the Lord teaches and warns us about. But if we say, well, I don't have that problem because I talk just like they do. Well, then what are we? Well, that's what's coming right at the beginning of chapter 4 in James. But if we are a friend of the world, it's going to flow right on into that particular topic in the beginning of James 4. We're getting to the end of chapter 3, but that's where we're heading. Are we like the world? If we are, if we're a friend of the world, then what are we with God? Then we're the enemy of God. Well, how can we tell we're a friend of the world? Well, are we of the earth? Are we earthy? Is that where our wisdom is? Is that what we speak of? So this is very important that we understand these things and that we look at ourselves in the mirror and examine all of this of ourselves. And then if we say, people I like to hang out with, they're the people in the world. The ones that I like to talk with are those ones in the world. And we talk about the things of the world and I'm right in there with it. If that's the way it is, then we got a problem. And we need to know, recognize that and then do something about it. John chapter 19 and verse 11. This was, we'll actually look at verses 9 through 11. It says, or 8 through 11. When Pilate therefore heard that saying, he was the more afraid. When the Jews told him that Jesus had made himself the Son of God. That made Pilate afraid when he heard that. So verse 9, he went again unto the judgment hall and saith unto Jesus, whence art thou? Now this is after he had questioned Jesus about, are you the King of the Jews? When they had falsely accused him of being a rival to Caesar and committing treason, in essence, by trying to make himself a king. And then he questioned Jesus about that, and Jesus told him that his kingdom was not of this world. So there again, we have the contrast. Jesus was not of this world. He didn't speak of this world. His kingdom wasn't of this world. Pilate recognized, even though he really didn't understand exactly who Jesus was, he knew that he was no threat to Caesar, and whatever he was talking about, it was not some earthly kingdom that was going to be a rival to Rome. But then when he goes back to the Jews and says he didn't find any fault in him, and then they're telling him this, that he's made himself the Son of God, and so he should die, then that made Pilate afraid, and he goes back and asks Jesus, where are you from? Now, that question, what's Pilate's motive with that question? Now, when he asks Jesus, are you the King of the Jews? He's trying to find out from Jesus to be able to discern whether the accusation against him from the Jews was valid and whether he was guilty of treason and a rival to Caesar. And he found that answer out, and then he recognized, okay, that's not right. He's not. There's no fault in him. He's not guilty of treason. Now when he says, where are you from? What's the motive for that? Is he trying to find out based on some accusation? Or is he now, this, had he ever had anybody before him like this? Of course not. I mean, he has been putting on trial the Son of God. And that term comes to him, and he's afraid now. He's recognizing this individual here is unlike anybody I've ever seen before. And so when he hears the Son of God, he's saying, where did you come from? He's wanting to know that. He's wanting to know who this man really is that he's got before him. Jesus gave him no answer, it says in verse 9. Answers nothing. Verse 10, then saith Pilate unto him, speakest thou not unto me? Knowest thou not that I have power to crucify thee and have power to release thee? He's telling him, look, I've got authority to either have you killed or set free, and you're not going to answer me? What did Jesus say in verse 11? Jesus answered, "Thou couldst have no power at all against me, except it were given thee from above. Therefore, he that delivered me unto thee hath the greater sin." Now, it says in verse 12, "From thenceforth Pilate sought to release him." He knew he was dealing with somebody that was innocent and that was otherworldly. He was not from here. His kingdom wasn't, he wasn't, and he was at least seeing that much at that point. But Jesus pointed that out. I mean, he's saying, "Here, I have all this power." And Jesus says, you wouldn't have any of that power. The only reason you do is my Father gave it to you. And therefore, who delivered me to you, to use that power, has the greater sin. But he says, "Except it were given thee from above." So when it comes to true authority, where does that come from? From above. That's what is the case with God's authority. If it's real authority, then it comes from God. It's from above. Now this was James 1:17. We saw the same word in the book of James already. Also, where did he say about every good and every perfect gift? Where does it come from? From above. Where do all the other gifts come from? Not from there. So we've seen this phrase before. In Matthew chapter 21, Jesus presented this when he was questioned by these Jewish leaders. He presented this question back to them. He answered their question with a question and sat them squarely on the horns of a dilemma. Matthew 21, 23 through 27 says, "When he was come unto the temple, the chief priests and the elders of the people came unto him as he was teaching and said, 'By what authority doest thou these things, and who gave thee this authority?'" Now, of course, it's a little bit later chronologically that we have what he said in John 19, 11 to Pilate. True authority, if it exists, where does it come from? So what would be the actual answer when they're saying, "By what authority do you do these things, and who gave you this authority?" The answer is, "It's from above, from my Father. He gave it to me." But instead of answering it like that, he answered in verse, I can never read this without chuckling to myself. But in verse 24, I absolutely love this. "And Jesus answered and said unto them, I will ask you one thing, which if you tell me, I likewise will tell you by what authority I do these things. The baptism of John, whence was it, from heaven or of men?" But see, that's the choice. Isn't that the same thing he's speaking about in James 3 about wisdom? It's either from above, from heaven, or it's of men. That's true of everything. I mean, that's the question we need to be asking. If it's from God, that's what we need. We need to identify what is from Him, what is from heaven, from above, and we need to follow that with all of our hearts. But if we discern that something is not from Him, then what do we need to do? We need to run from it as fast and far as we can. So Jesus asked them that question of the baptism of John because it can only be one or the other. Was it from heaven or of men? Now, if they had actually answered his question, would he have done what he said and answered the one they had asked him? Certainly. But he knew they wouldn't, obviously. And so they reasoned with themselves, saying, "If we shall say from heaven, he will say unto us, 'Why did you not then believe him?' But if we shall say of men, we fear the people, for all hold John as a prophet." And they answered Jesus and said, "We cannot tell." And he said unto them, "Neither tell I you by what authority I do these things." So he put them there in that dilemma that they'd made for themselves by their hypocrisy. What did they actually believe about the baptism of John? If they had answered the question honestly, what would they have said? They would have said of men, but they were afraid to say that because they would have been rejected by the people, because the people believed the baptism of John was from heaven. So here they are just trying to deceive the people, being utterly dishonest. And what do you call that but a hypocrite? They don't believe what the people do, but they want the people to think they believe what the people do. It's a good thing we don't have people like that around anymore. Oops, I guess we do, don't we? Well, they were trying to deceive the people on this, but they weren't deceiving Christ, and he knew what they believed on that. But that is the truth. It's either from heaven or it's of men. Now, if we go a little bit further, what is of men is from where? What is of the earth is actually from the devil. There's one of two sources. It's either God or Satan. So what is not from above, what is of the earth, or what is of men is actually from Satan. We also need to recognize this, and we'll close here in John 8, 21 to 24, because this is true of us. I mean, based on what we're believing and following, if we have this wisdom that is not from above, if we are of this world and we speak of this world, we're following the wisdom of this world and the things that are of this world, and that's what we love, and that's what we believe, and that's what we're doing, then where are we from? John 8, 21 to 24. Then said Jesus again unto them, I go my way, and ye shall seek me, and shall die in your sins. Whither I go, you cannot come. Now that would be the saddest thing, because Jesus was going to be going to his Father. And those that are of this world can't go there. They're not going to be allowed. So verse 23, then said the Jews, will he kill himself? Because he saith, whither I go, you cannot come. And he said unto them, ye are from beneath, I am from above. Ye are of this world, I am not of this world. I said therefore unto you that you shall die in your sins, for if you believe not that I'm he, you shall die in your sins. I mean, we're either from where? I mean, we're either of this world or we're not. Jesus wasn't. Now, obviously, we didn't come from heaven like he did, but that's where he belonged. That, and he was of the Father, from the Father, and everything he did was according to his Father's will. Why did he say you're from beneath? Was it because they were born here? No, it was because that's where their heart was. That's what they loved. This is where their everything that they were about was from here. And of this world. And if we love this world, can we love the Father? We can't. So he was identifying where they were from. And we either belong here or we don't belong here. And if we don't belong here, then we belong with him. But that's the question we need to ask ourselves. It's what he said about that wisdom. It's either from above or not from above. But we're either identified as being with the one who's from above, or we are from beneath. And we can see the consequences of being from beneath. So those are questions we really have to ask ourselves. Jesus was telling them. They didn't believe him. They didn't believe that. They continued to believe their lie. But we can't afford to do that. So we need to really, really ask these questions. And that's why here in James 3, he's presenting this to us as an opportunity to examine ourselves on all of this. So we'll continue there, Lord willing, and finish up verse 15, Lord willing, next Wednesday night. And we'll get the assignments out here now as we close.